Hispanic Heritage Month. What is the significance there? Why is it so important that we are highlighting this month?
You know, the Latino population has multiple days that they celebrate. The Day of the Dead, for example, Cinco de Mayo is very, very well known. But the notion of celebrating the Hispanic Heritage Month came out of the 1960s. This is a time when we saw, you know, a new political realignment in the United States. There was a brown, black, and red power movements at that time. There was also an effort to validate the cultures of these three groups. There was a movement for women rights. All of these changes together coalesce into the need to identify those groups in the United States that have been marginalized and give voice to them. And in 1968, that's how the Hispanic Heritage Month started, with 1 week, and then later extended to a month-long celebration.
Interesting. So for clarity for those, including myself, I often get terms mixed up or ideas mixed up. Hispanic and Latino, they are often used interchangeably, but they are not. So if you could give us a little bit of an explanation.
Sure. You know, in Latin America, people don't use those terms because when you are in Colombia, you are Colombiano,
yeah.
Right? In Cuba, Cuban, and so on and so forth. When we enter the United States or when we are born and raised in the United States, people are curious about the identity, right? Early on, the terms that was being used were Spanish surname and Spanish speaking or Spanish speakers. The 1970s, in the 1970s, the U.S. Census Bureau was looking for a one word that could encapsulate, right, as an umbrella term, the diversity of the Hispanic population, and they came up with the word Hispanic. There were some people at that time, and I was one of them, who did not enjoy or like that term. Why? Because at that particular time, Hispanic referenced the Spanish heritage from Europe, from the word Hispanic. It did not give value, right, to the culture of American Indians, Africans, Asians, that are also embedded and are intermingled with what we now call the Latino population. So therefore, in the 1980s, people began to come up with a new term, and they used the word Latino. In more recent time, people felt that as those that were in the younger generations felt the need to come up with a different way, so they adopted Malcolm X's idea of Latinx.
I always wonder where the X came from in Latinx, because I always hear it, and sometimes I'll hear, you know, well, I don't want to be called Latinx, or I prefer Latino, or, you know, whatever it may be, but that's the historical significance of the X in Latinx. I had no idea.
Yeah, and in some people, in some circles, Latinx became problematic, mm-hmm. because I heard from colleagues of mine who said, you know, Latinx presupposes the existence of an unidentified identity, mm-hmm. an X. As in algebra, and X is, until you solve it, there's no real meaning. And so they say, hey, we know our identity, so we're not really Latinx, right? But so there has been discussions around that.
And based on history, you know, we think about the large population that we have, especially in Southwest Detroit. We talked a little bit earlier as well. You talked about the hubs. But before we get to there, what was the main draw to the city of Detroit for Hispanic communities, especially throughout history, and especially if we think about Great Migration?
You know, I kind of like to simplify things in terms of push and pull factors, right? What pushes people out of their homelands or their countries that want to take a chance, let's say, to make it across a border or across a river, across a mountain, or really just get on a plane and come to a new land. In the case of Latinos from the U.S. Southwest, there were the top three reasons that I've been able to identify. One of them was discrimination. As the United States evolved into a continental power in the 19th century, we occupied parts of the land that used to belong to Mexico. They called this the Mexican Cession. The people in those territories were forced to essentially give up their lands and give up their culture, give up their language. And as Mexicanos in Texas, in other places, New Mexico, California, and so on, when they felt that they couldn't get, you know, any type of meaningful social mobility, they decided to leave in the same way as African Americans did in the U.S. South through the Great Migration that occurred from the 1910s to about the 1970s, except that in the case of Latinos from the U.S. Southwest, they began coming here as early as the, you know, second half of the 19th century.
And when we think about the expansion, of course, we think about the migration here to the city of Detroit. We talked a little bit earlier before the show. There are other hubs or little pockets throughout the state of Michigan that are also home to large populations of Hispanic communities.
Yes, and that kind of brings me to the pull factors, right? What is it about Detroit or Michigan that people wanted to be here? One of the pull factors and the reason why there are pockets or Latino communities is the railroads. The very earliest migration of Latinos from the U.S. Southwest to the state of Michigan were people who work as what they call section hands, the individuals that laid down the tracks that created the railroad system. And in Spanish, they were known as traqueros or track workers. And then when the sugar beet economy started booming in the 1880s to about the 1930s, the sugar beets became a type of industry that required a lot of field workers. So a lot of companies from here began recruiting using agents that went down to the Southwest to try to lure people from those communities to come to Detroit and other places throughout the state of Michigan, and they started working on that. And then the last industry, the one that was, you know, that's still around, is the automobile industry. And as year-round employment became available, people did not have to go back. And that explains why there's these pockets of communities, because people could now work year-round as opposed to just working in the fields and then returning back to the Southwest.
So, Dr. Chinia, as a professor of history, you've been studying, you understand what's been going on with migration and population movement and density, but, you know, whatever it may be in the city of Detroit. Detroit simply doesn't know as much as they should about their Latino neighbors, brothers and sisters. What are things that we just don't know?
You know, the one thing that probably we don't know is that, particularly on the Mexican side of the Latinos, because Puerto Ricans came in a little later, 1920s, 1930s, particularly in the post-1940s, when the airplanes were being used for civil aviation. Before that, they were used in the war effort. And so when those became available, people could, you know, get on those airlines and come to the United States from farther afield, like from Puerto Rico and Cuba. But the Mexicano population is the oldest, one of the oldest populations in the state of Michigan, since they began coming here right around the 1880s and have been steadily developing their communities in the state. However, another thing that we don't really know a lot about is that the Mexicano or the Mexican-American population, they lost half their population in the 1930s during the Great Depression. The U.S. Department of Labor decided that there was an excess population in the U.S. that could not be accommodated through social services or regular employment, and they started promoting a campaign to get those foreign groups to leave the state and go back to their native lands. Some of the Mexicanos that were born in Detroit, unfortunately, were targeted for that, and they ended up in Texas when, in fact, they were born in the state of Michigan. So that's the second most important development in the area. The other one is that as of 2008, the Latino population contributed $10 billion to the Southeast Michigan economy. And the report that was done, it was completed by my center in that year, it showed that for every job in which a Latino person was working, they developed another job for a non-Latino. So it was a multiplier effect that has not been properly acknowledged.
Wow. You know, it's just, we can talk forever about this. We truly can. But as we get closer towards the end of the conversation, I want to move down a little bit. And, you know, what are some organizations right now that are pushing and supporting Latino communities here in Detroit, but Metro Detroit, as well as the state of Michigan, but mostly Metro Detroit here?
In the Metro Detroit area, one of the p- peculiarities of this region is that there has always been a shortage of services provided either by the state, the city, or the county. And oftentimes, local agency has sprung up to take care of those needs. So the agencies that are much more involved in that area in the Latino community are Latin Americans for Social and Economic Development, CHAS, which stands for the Center for Social Service. I cannot get the acronym right now. We also have SER Metro, S-E-R Metro Detroit. And there are a couple of other agencies that provide, you know, job training, bilingual education, courses for getting people back into school, like the GED program. The Detroit Hispanic Development Corporation particularly does that. And they also get youth involved in media and in other activities.
So, Dr. Chinia, this is my last question here before I let you go. What are other important moments in history? We just heard about the historic placard, Tejano Music, here in the city of Detroit. It's in Southwest Detroit, that new placard. I would be remiss if I didn't say WDET was also on that placard because we were one of those radio stations who were one of the first in the city of Detroit playing Tejano Music. So when we think about Tejano Music, we think about the contributions to just diversity here in the city of Detroit. I see the smile on your face already. What do you think about that historic marker?
I have always been fascinated by music.
Yeah.
And back in 1978, I started a program at WHRW in Detroit, in Binghamton, New York. But Tejano music is part of the culture that came out of Texas and through the migration process and got readapted here, and it thrived in this community, is alive in this area. And also there's been other kinds of music like salsa, reggaeton, merengue, bachata from the Dominican Republic and other places. So the diversity of musical tastes that Latinos have provided to this region is very diverse, and it has enriched the area, and it continues to draw the attention of people who may not be familiar with it, who are now learning about the culture through music.
Dr. Chinia is a Wayne State Professor of History. Thank you so much for joining the show, chatting with us about the history of the city of Detroit. You have one more thing. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to clarify, CHAS stands for Community Health and Social Services. I apologize for that the name would not come up when I needed to state it.
Not a problem. We went through so many different topics in a short time span, but you did bring a song to us, Amanda LeClaire. Shout out to Amanda LeClaire, who's working behind the scenes right now, really, really well. And she just picked up this song, dropped it in for us, but you said it was
Suavecito.
There we go. Suavecito. Amanda?
Yeah, I think I got the right one. From 1972.
Yeah.
This became a cross-cultural hit, lowrider classic.
Okay.
Right? Is this the one we're talking about?
It could be. Go ahead,
okay.
Try it.
Let's do it. It's a great song anyway.
Yeah. He says, go ahead, try it.
Yeah.
So we're just going to go.
Music is always changing. Somebody writes and composes a song. Somebody else reinterprets it, mm-hmm. as different instrumentation, enriches it. So
Here we go. Amanda found it, so we're going to start it on up right here on Culture Shift. Dr. Chinia, once again, thank you so much for chatting with us, and we look forward to speaking with you in the future.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed the interview.
Nice.